Are you interested in the paranormal? Murder mystery? Real natural law? Do you enjoy interviews with amazing guests? Then join Crypt Rick every Monday night, 6 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, right here on Revolution Radio. Studio A, freedomslips.com. Crypt Rick's iPhone, thank you. Welcome to the Crypt.
Many years from now, would you be willing to trade all the days from this day to that for one chance, just one chance, to come back here and tell our enemies that they may take our lives, but they'll never take our freedom!
The future is uncertain, I know this. Death is inevitable, I know this. But one thing is certain, as free men, it is our right to live unencumbered and in peace. And those times are quickly drawing to an end. And in these times, peace is certainly an illusion, and as the chains grow tighter, our ability to slip those chains increase incrementally with every passing moment. Inaction is no longer an option. It's time to raise our voices like a cacophony of thunder and lightning, and tell the masters no more. And this is Nighthawk, and I say, for myself, no more. Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com, because the freedom is slipping away.
LAX is closed to the general public 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. No entry is allowed except for airline passengers and persons paying.
Now is the time for counter-speech with Dina Sachs.
Dina
will guide us through the convoluted corridors of the American legal system, and she will explain how the people can reclaim their country and restore true democracy.
Thank you.
Okay, one reminder for Southwest flight number 1220 with services to Oakland. We're now at the end of our boarding process. All ticketed and confirmed passengers, please make your way to gate 12A for an on-time departure.
I'm not hearing anything.
May I have your attention, please? All travelers, if any unknown person attempts to give you any item, including luggage, to transport on your flight,
hi, everyone. This is Dina Sachs, and you're listening to Counter Speech on Revolution Radio. Sorry for the technical problems there. I had a little scheduling glitch. I'm at LAX and found this little setup here, so thank you for your patience. And I have the most awesome young lawyer I've met in a very long time. Dana Weaver is here. Thank you so much for joining me, Dana.
Thank you for having me. I'm really excited to be here, Dina.
Yeah, me too. This has been such a big week with the Dobbs case and the majority opinion is 79 pages long, and I did read that word for word. I didn't read all the footnotes, but I read it word for word. I did scan the three concurring opinions and glanced over the dissent, and I thought we should start with that because everyone's going to want to know about that. Did you have a chance to read any part of that?
So I read the opinion when it was leaked. I'm hoping that it's not too different. And I read Thomas's opinion, not as carefully as I intend to, but...
Right. So, yeah, I did not get a hold of the leaked opinion. I tried to for last week, I think it was, but I couldn't find it. So I got the real opinion here, and this is just the majority opinion minus the appendices. So this is just the 79 pages. And for the listeners, I want to be clear so that a lot of people don't really know what the court does and how it does it. So just to be clear, this case is a 6-3 opinion with a 5-member majority in the reasoning for the judgment. And then the Chief Justice Roberts concurred in the judgment, but not the reasoning. So we have Justice Alito writing the opinion. We have Thomas, Gorsuch, Kavanaugh, and Barrett signing on to Alito's opinion. And then we have Chief Justice Roberts signing on to the judgment, but not the opinion. And then we have dissenters Breyer, Sotomayor, and Kagan. So basically, a Mississippi law came before the court where if a person wanted abortion, if a female wanted an abortion, she has to have it within 15 weeks of getting pregnant. Otherwise, she can no longer have an abortion. So we talked about this on a prior show, and my prior guest said she felt 15 weeks was long enough to figure out if you're pregnant and long enough to take action. How do you feel about that, Dana? Is 15 weeks long enough to find out you're pregnant and have a chance to get an abortion?
You know, as a practical matter, I think it probably is for most people, but there are going to be outliers. There are going to be people that just don't know. We have an interesting case in the Third Circuit many years ago that's not related to abortion, but it actually was an invasion of privacy case for a student, a high school student whose teacher, whose gym teacher suspected she was pregnant and so, like, made her take a pregnancy test. And it turned out he violated her rights in doing that. But the interesting thing about it was her pregnancy test came back negative, and then she ended up giving birth to a baby a couple months later. And apparently that's because if you progress past too far past the end of the first trimester, the hormone that's detected on the pregnancy test, it just stops showing up, or it's too high or something. So you can get these false.
Oh, interesting. I did not know that. That's really interesting. And just so people know, I met Dana because I've been working on these vaccine mandate cases and trying to figure out why they're all failing. Dana Weaver has written the single best pleadings, motions that I've seen. And this young lady has really gone, you know, over the top. She has not been paid for most of this work, and she's doing far, far better work than the organizations getting millions and millions in donations. So I'm going to announce right now, I now have a donate button on meettheprofessors.org. That's my original talk show, meettheprofessors.org. It's online, and if you donate, in the next 30 days, 50% goes directly to Dana Weaver for her work. So please do get on, support our litigation. This 100% of the donations go to litigation costs and fees. That means filing fees. It means deposition costs. It means document production. It means attorney's fees. 100% to the donations to Counter Speech go directly to litigation, unlike a lot of other organizations. We are going to fight this fight. We're going to fight it right. So, Dana, the thing I liked about you and your pleadings was you didn't leave anything out. I mean, you are set for appeal. Now, what we talked about earlier is what I'm going to do is fill in history and tradition of this right to medical freedom. And it does relate to the case Dobbs versus Jackson, which we'll get to in just a minute. But the thing is that what all the lawyers have not been able to do or just haven't had the time to do or didn't know to do is to trace the history of the right back to the English common law and earlier. If you want to establish a fundamental right, you have to prove it. And what the court has said to various lower courts have said to various litigants is that, you know, you're saying you have a fundamental right to avoid these vaccinations, but where's the beef? They didn't present a case. And a lot of lawyers just don't. Either I know you've been overwhelmed. You've done a fabulous job with your time constraints. I mean, you've got so many pro bono cases, getting paid nothing. Like me, I've been paid almost nothing for over a year now working on these cases. You know, to go through the history, you almost have to be a constitutional law professor and a torts professor, because that's the only way you can trace back the right not to have people touch your body. Because that right goes back way, way before our Constitution was adopted, and that right turned into the right of informed consent, to be told exactly what's going to be done to you medically before you consent. Otherwise, the consent is invalid. and consent can be invalidated by just failing to tell the patient all the things the average reasonable patient would want to know before they have a procedure, or by fraud. And this gets interesting because the Pfizer documents seem to indicate that a lot of people took this so-called vaccine because they thought it was a vaccine, and it was not a vaccine. At the time these shots were being administered, the definition of vaccine excluded these gene therapy shots. And so what happened was the CDC and various dictionaries changed their definition in late 2021 so that Pfizer and Moderna could call this mRNA gene therapy a vaccine. But at the time that they were telling the people that they're a vaccine, they were not a vaccine. And I would argue they're still not a vaccine. I mean, changing the definition of something doesn't change what it is. But anyway, I'm so glad to have you today. Did you have a chance? You read Justice Thomas's concurring opinion?
Yeah, so I read Alito's leaked opinion. I don't know how different it was, but I imagine the reasoning is probably largely the same. Maybe there were some edits. And I read Thomas's opinion. I spent the first Supreme Court case I actually read the gun one that came down. That was the one that I spent the last couple of days in. And I read Thomas's opinion because I kept seeing these quotes online where people were like, they're coming after all your rights. And I was like, wow, let me put this in context. So I went and looked at his opinion. Mm-hmm. And I think it's really interesting. I think, you know, one of the things that we're going to be dealing with as we move up here is the last week has made clear we are dealing with a new court. They're going in new directions.
Which may not be a bad thing. Reading this opinion, I have to tell you, knowing constitutional law as I do, and knowing the way that the powers have been delegated, Kavanaugh's opinion was fascinating to me because he basically made a non-delegation argument that the court lacked delegated authority under the Constitution to do this. I'll get to that in a minute, but I want to read first what the majority said. There were five justices signed on to this opinion, and they completely overruled Roe versus Wade. And what the Chief Justice said, Roberts said, they didn't have to do that. I have to agree with Chief Justice Roberts. They did not have to overrule Roe. They could have just said this Mississippi law is constitutional. But here's what the court said. We hold that Roe and Casey must be overruled. The Constitution makes no reference to abortion, and no such right is implicitly protected by any constitutional provision, including the one on which defenders of Roe and Casey now chiefly rely, the Due Process Clause of the 14th Amendment. That provision has been held to guarantee some rights that are not mentioned in the Constitution, but any such right must be deeply rooted in this nation's history and tradition, and implicit in the concept of ordered liberty, citing Washington versus Glucksberg, of course. Glucksberg gave us the clearest indication of how we know whether a right really is fundamental or not. But here's the interesting thing about Glucksberg. It came on the heels of Cruzan. And Cruzan assumed there was a right to die, to reject medical treatment. They didn't make that finding because they didn't have to for the outcome of the case. But they said that they're going to assume. Well, of course they're going to assume there's a right to die because the right to reject medical treatment goes way, way back. It has to do with the way that all humans get, well, in our history, in American history, in English common law history, and even going way back to, I've got some cases from the 1400s. So going way back, we've always had a right, our people, our culture, the people who came and made America, not to be touched if you don't want to be touched. And this goes to everything from dueling to being hit by a rock inadvertently by somebody blasting or by being kissed without your consent. It goes to any kind of touching and began to include any kind of medical touching in the last couple hundred years. So that's where the informed consent doctrine came from, was this original rule that no one gets to touch your body, period, end of story. It's a natural right. It's been recognized for hundreds and hundreds of years. I mean, it's hard to find authority before 1400. I mean, it's just, you know, we're going to find a rock somewhere with it scratched on the side of a cave, you know, so it's really hard. But in looking through, I did find some really early authority, and thank goodness for people like Dan Dobbs and other torts professors who have traced it back, and I found some authority in his treatise. So really happy to find that. But I want to make sure, break this down, what this means, what this court is saying, what the Supreme Court said in Dobbs versus Jackson is that there are implicit rights in the Due Process Clause. Not every single right that the Founding Fathers thought was important enough to guarantee as a fundamental right is in the Constitution. And the reason why is because certain things were obvious, right? I mean, you didn't have to write everything down. In the amendments, what they did is they made clear those rights that are so important to us that they made them constitutional amendments. The right to worship as you please, the right to free speech, the right to bear arms, the right against unreasonable searches and seizures, to have counsel in a criminal proceeding, against the right against self-incrimination, the Fifth Amendment. So those are the rights that are called enumerated rights. And the court in Dobbs versus Jackson went through and explained how enumerated rights and some implicit rights are all in there. But the problem with Roe is that it found this sort of right and said, well, we don't really know where it is. The Roe court said, we don't really know where it is. Several provisions it could come under. It could come under the Ninth Amendment. It could come under the Due Process Clause. It could come under the Fourth Amendment. All these different areas of the Constitution, Roe kind of glossed over that and didn't trace the history of abortion to see if, indeed, we've had the right for a very long time. And it turns out, no, we didn't. Abortion's been illegal throughout history, throughout English history, throughout American history, by and large. Almost all countries in the world had a law against abortion. So if you look at the actual analysis of the court, it's probably accurate. I mean, when you look at a fundamental right, one of the things the court said over and over is you look to what was going on in 1868 when the 14th Amendment was adopted, because that's the period of time, this court says, when you have to look at what did they mean by liberty. Remember, the Fifth Amendment has a liberty clause, but the Fifth Amendment only applies to the federal government. So the 14th Amendment was then passed later and said the states also must give some amount of due process to their people, because they're a government too, and we can't have the states going, running roughshod over our people's rights. Now, each of the enumerated rights, the Bill of Rights, were incorporated one by one over the course of so far 100 years. So the first one was like the right to religious freedom, which was in the late 1800s, then Gitlow versus New York in 1925, the right of free speech. But those rights have been incorporated one by one, except I think the Seventh Amendment, which is probably unnecessary. It's a right to a jury trial in a civil matter. But the implicit rights are the big, big question right now. The implicit rights, the right to abortion, gone. Not in the Constitution, not a fundamental right, not something our founding fathers expected to give our people. And realistically, not something that is so deeply rooted in our history that it is considered fundamental. But think about this. Abortion is different than rejecting medication. So I had some colleagues here who worried about this case. Do you think this case has really hurt our chances of getting the U.S. Supreme Court to see that the right to reject vaccinations is fundamental? And I said no. And the difference is that the law historically over hundreds of years has promised us that no one can touch our bodies. We own our bodies. So you have to have consent with all kinds of touching, including medical touching. But at the same time, we did not have the right to abortion over that same several hundred year period. So I'm not really concerned about this case in terms of the way they handled the implicit rights analysis. I think it's spot on. I think it's accurate. I do prefer if women have a choice. Abortion for me it troubles me what I've heard, especially the partial birth abortions. But for me, it's a women's rights issue. But the bottom line is it's not in the Constitution. And it isn't a right that's been around for so many hundreds of years that we can expect it and we can deem it fundamental. Do you agree with that part, Dana?
So I think that one of the things I've struggled with the vaccine cases, the quote-unquote vaccine cases, is that the law is well established that you have the right to reject medical treatment. And I think that both vaccines and abortions sort of are exceptions to that.
Service is staging ADM, cleaning crew to gate 13, please.
Vaccines, I don't think, are as much, but there is this argument that, it's for the public good, and so there's at least a 100-year history of forcing people to get vaccinated. And I know I've read some anecdotes about George Washington forcing the church to take smallpox vaccine. But I think that the question we might be addressing here is, we know that we have a right to reject medical treatment. And maybe in some cases, and so ultimately, it's not the federal government. It's not a authority that's given to the federal government. So the question that the Supreme Court has to resolve is, does the right stay with the states or the people? And in the case of abortion, they said it's the state. And I think that was probably the right answer because abortion is such a morally complicated issue. And I think that our job is going to make sure that when we get to the question of when it comes to vaccines, medical treatments, or anything like that, that we establish that it stays with the people and that that is how it's distinguished. It's all right. It doesn't belong to the federal government. It's reserved to the people or the state. Which one?
Yeah. And well, I mean, a couple caveats there. The only group that's been subjected to vaccination in order to obtain public benefits. Keep in mind, it's not a general rule of applicability. It was in Jacobson. However, it was get vaccinated or pay $5. It was right in the statute, one or the other. That was the only vaccination law of general applicability that we've ever dealt with. Every other law until the COVID pandemic was childhood vaccinations to attend school. So there's never been any precedent for adults to have to get vaccinated other than Jacobson. But again, that wasn't a mandate. It wasn't a compulsory law. It was just a law that said either get vaccinated or pay $5. And again, $5 today is $166.08. $166, you know, it's not chicken feed, but it also isn't losing your job. It also isn't losing all your tuition. It is nothing compared to what people are going through right now. And the vaccine, of course, too, wasn't experimental. They didn't have FDA approval back there, as I understand it, back in the Jacobson days. However, it'd been around 100 years. If there was an approval process, it would have been approved. And a few people got sick, but nothing like the COVID vaccines or so-called vaccines. What's happening to our people, they're getting really sick and they're dying. And Pfizer, we now know, withheld information from the public, critical information from the public. So, you know, it was kind of fraud-induced consent to something that wasn't a vaccine at all. It's a whole different story, and the penalties are extraordinary. So I am not concerned about the school vaccine precedent. And another thing that people don't realize is back when the school vaccine mandates were coming down, they were all about smallpox. And I traced them all back in my article coming out as soon as Florida State can publish it. I don't know what's going on there. It was slated for April. But I traced back all those cases and found that, first of all, they all related to smallpox, all the early cases. And then they just sort of glossed over. The court started just mimicking, oh, it's a legislative issue, and just completely abdicating their responsibility. Just ignoring their responsibility to be that branch that oversees the legislature to make sure they're protecting our rights. And so I go through all of them. And something the court said, which I thought was really interesting, because the court in Dobbs versus Jackson this last week did mention that. And they're talking about all the reasons why they want to get rid of Roe, because so many reasons. But one of the things they mention here on page 45 is the quality of the reasoning. When the quality of the reasoning of the prior cases doesn't stand up under critical analysis, the prior cases should probably be overruled. I do not think vaccine mandates for school children probably should stand up today. With what we know, with the statistics on children getting hurt, with the way the National Childhood Vaccine Injury Act has been expanded and the way that the vaccine manufacturers have increased the number of vaccines for children, I think there needs to be a very serious study done to see if the vaccines are actually working. People get saying, oh, well, we don't have big, you know, smallpox anymore, we don't have mumps anymore, measles because of the vaccines. Well, how do we know that? Without a study, and Congress has been, you know, many requests have come in for Congress to do a real study and find out if it's vaccination that really stopped the proliferation of the diseases, or if it's the fact that we have sanitation services now, and at the same time that the smallpox vaccine was assumed to work and all the other vaccines, all diseases also dropped off. So whether there was a vaccine or not, diseases all took a dive when sanitation systems became commonplace. So I think you might have mentioned that. What do you think about that, Dana, about do we even know that vaccines are the hero? Do we even know that?
So, you know, I think you're hitting on an interesting point and one that I'm a little concerned about, because I think that people who are fighting the mandates for freedom were ahead of the judges on this and were ahead of the Supreme Court on this. And I think that we're going to have a hard time, because they're going to say, well, what about all these other vaccines? So even if they are skeptical of the COVID vaccine, or even if there are concerns about whether the COVID vaccine is actually a vaccine, that they would be afraid that stating that we have, say, a fundamental right specifically to reject vaccines is going to open up this whole can of worms. I'm taking some hope in the fact that this court apparently has no problem striking down old precedents. The law that they struck down in New York was a 100-year-old statute that they just held unconstitutional. So I think that the Supreme Court, as it's currently constituted, is very different from what we've seen. So I'm hopeful that maybe that will not be an issue. But you know, that one of my concerns is that judges in particular may say that if they open this can of worms, it could be undoing all of these other good vaccines, which generally are regarded very favorably, whether they ought to be or not. And that I'm concerned that the court, for that reason, and particularly Justice Gorsuch, who I think is actually very good on these issues and is of all the justices has been the least alarmist during the pandemic. But I've read so many of his opinions where he assumes that the authority to decide something stays with the state and not the person. So that's really my concern here, is that they might just do like what they did with Dobbs and say, it's a police power, it belongs to the state.
Well, they have an obligation to trace the history back, and actually that's our job. And for the listeners, I am actually in the middle of drafting an amicus brief for one of Dana's cases that is in the, did you file the notice of appeal this week?
Yeah.
The Third Circuit. Okay, so she has one in the Third Circuit right now. She's on the case coming up to the Third Circuit. Third Circuit, sorry. That was a Freudian slip. It'd be the Ninth Circuit, by the way, no. The Third Circuit. So, so I'm doing the amicus brief, and what I'm doing is I'm going to trace the law back hundreds of years to show that we have had the right to reject medicine, all kinds of treatments throughout history. The only case where a medical procedure was forced on someone is Buck v. Bell. And the young lady was sterilized without her consent, and so was her sister, and her sister was never told for like decades and found out when she was in their 60s and then finally realized why she and her husband could never get pregnant. But that's considered one of the worst cases in U.S. history. I mean, Buck v. Bell was brutal. And so that is not, and you know, they actually relied on Jacobson in that case too. So that case has not actually been overruled, but in Skinner versus Oklahoma, they basically said you have to apply strict scrutiny because it's a medical procedure someone doesn't want. I don't know how anyone can seriously accept vaccines from this. Vaccination is a serious medical procedure. It causes some people to die. It's caused more death and more injuries than all vaccinations throughout the history of this country combined. If you look at the vaccine adverse effect reporting system, which is all we have, because God knows our government really isn't tracking it, and neither are the big pharma companies. So that's all we have. What we know is the vaccinations are extremely dangerous relative to other vaccinations, probably because they're not vaccinations at all, not the Pfizer and Moderna. This opinion didn't shake me at all. I still feel very confident that when lawyers put together the right argument, and we need to prove to the courts a fundamental right. We can't just say it. We have to say, because everyone's coming to court saying, we have a fundamental right. It's like, wait, why? Why? Because throughout history, no one gets to touch your body, period. I mean, we just, before 1850, it was strict liability. If someone walked by and, you know, dropped something and hit your foot, strict liability. No need to show negligence. No need to show intent. That was the law in this country until 1850. So it was so serious not to touch anyone under any circumstances. That if you have a direct hit on someone's body, you're strictly liable, essentially. So that changed in 1850 when the court adopted a negligence standard. But that is a powerful point, that in this country historically and into the back to the English common law days, no one gets to touch you. And that, again, is where we have the derivation of the right against medical treatments without consent, without informed consent. So I still feel... You know, it's very, now imagine if a state wanted to force abortion on you. Now we've got a parallel case, okay? Because asking for an abortion, seeking a medical procedure is very different than being told you must have a medical procedure. So if you're going to make an analogy here, the analogy would have to be a law requiring women to have an abortion. Now, does anyone really think that that would stand? And setting aside religion, I mean, you're talking about someone making you do something you don't want to do.
I think the converse of that is that people who are upset that abortion is not a fundamental right would say that they're being forced to give birth when they don't want to.
Right, but again, I'm a pro-choice person. I think women should have the choice. wouldn't be my choice, probably, but that's my choice. So I am a pro-choice person, but I also feel like this is something that's just going to have to go, as the court said, to the states. I would like to think that our people would all have the right to control their destiny and control their bodies. But unfortunately, if you really research the constitutional law on this, there just isn't the law. There's no fundamental right to an abortion. And it isn't explicit, of course, but then neither is. And this, I'm going to answer Justice Thomas for a minute, because Justice Thomas says basically there's due process just means process. That's all it means. There's no such thing as substantive due process rights. I'm sorry. That's, to me, kind of ridiculous. Because without some substantive rights, process isn't enough. Let's say, for example, the government passed a law in L.A., and they said if you get caught going 1 mile an hour over the highway speed limit, we take your house. We take your cars. We take your 401k. We take everything you own because you were 1 mile an hour, 1 mile per one. You're 1 mile going 1 mile too fast over the speed limit. Now think about that. If they give you a hearing and notice and a trial, you've had due process procedurally. But if there's no substantive component to the due process clause, they could take everything you own for a very minor infraction or a parking ticket. There has to be a substantive aspect of the due process clause, or else you could see all sorts of things. I mean, things that aren't in the Constitution because the founding fathers never would have imagined that anyone wouldn't know these things. For natural rights, for example, could the government just walk into your house at night and just start eating out of your refrigerator? Well, it's not in the Constitution, Justice Thomas. Nothing in the Constitution says that the government, police officers, military can't just walk into my house at night and start eating out of my refrigerator. But we all know they can't do that. So I think that you can't really take seriously there's no substantive component to the due process clause. The question is, how do we define what that means? So Justice Thomas, I think, clearly would get rid of the substantive due process limits to punitive damages, right, BMW? I agree with that, too. Where in the Constitution is there a fundamental right not to go out of business when you've done something so bad that a jury assesses punitive damages to put you out of business? Where is that in the Constitution? So I think there's a lot of interesting questions have been raised. Now, things like Lawrence v. Texas, I think the writing's on the wall. I mean, Lawrence v. Texas is going to probably be reversed. And for those of you who don't know, Lawrence v. Texas, 2003, I think it was, case overruled Bowers versus Hardwick, which held that, Bowers versus Hardwick upheld a sodomy conviction against a man. Lawrence v. Texas said no, the right to private sexual relationships, whether it's homosexual or whatever it is, are part of your fundamental rights. So I think, and you know, something the court kept saying, like the court protested too much, you know, they kept saying, oh, this isn't going to affect any case other than abortion. And I'm like, okay, seriously? You just explained the limits to substance abuse process. You just explained that unless a right can be traced back hundreds of years, then it's not implicit in the Liberty Clause. So that would mean homosexual marriage, possibly. Unless, it depends on how they frame the issue. If they frame the issue as the right to marry, I think that is a fundamental right. But if they frame the issue as the right to marry as we've historically viewed marriage, bam, there it goes. There's no fundamental right between men to marry, between women to marry. Same thing with sodomy laws. So we're looking at, you know, potentially overturning a lot of the rights that we thought we had for a long time, because the U.S. Supreme Court has been so active since the 60s in creating new rights and finding them within one of the constitutional provisions, usually due process clause. So Justice Thomas, I read this and thought, I mean, I'm sorry, but you've got to have a substantive component or it doesn't mean anything. So imagine losing your house because you parked in the wrong place and got a parking ticket and they took your house away. You can't do that. It's too much. Substantive due process means there are certain things the government just can't do, no matter how much process they give you, no matter how many hearings, notices, doesn't matter. They can't do it because it exceeds what the government can do to us for infractions. There has to be proportionality. So you read Thomas's opinion. What do you think of Justice Thomas's opinion?
So I actually think that Justice Thomas, I wasn't sure what I was going to think going in, but I think he's right. And the reason I think that is because as I've been mulling all of this over, thinking about how it's going to go up to the Supreme Court, the thing that I've really struggled with is at the district court level and the appellate court level, obviously we're stuck arguing this is a fundamental right. And so the judges then engage in this balancing. And the thing that worries me is that the judicial system didn't work over the last couple of years. The damage has already been done. And so I don't like the idea of having to go to a court every time there's a new pandemic, every time there's a new vaccine, and basically begging the judges to do a weighing analysis and find it in our favor this time. So when I've struggled with how to do that, and I thought, well, maybe when we go up to the Supreme Court, we'll argue that this is an absolute right. This is beyond the fundamental right. But I really think that Justice Thomas's opinion in Dobbs gives the roadmap for that, where it's not I don't necessarily want, maybe for the other justice we argue, it's a fundamental right. But I think that with regard to him, it's a right that comes from somewhere else in the Constitution, not necessarily the substantive due process clause. And that could potentially, at least with Justice Thomas, get us out of the balancing, get us out of the tiered constitutional analysis where you have to judge the government's interest against the individual liberty.
And okay, well, yeah.
This is a right. This is a fundamental right. And like they did in the Second Amendment case just this past week, where they said it's a one-step test. Does this comport with the historical regulation that was allowed?
If then
you can't impinge on it.
Well, then it would be a Fourth Amendment seizure of the body, because some courts have said that spanking kids in school should be viewed as a Fourth Amendment seizure of the body. So sticking a needle into your body, I would think, would be a seizure of the body if a spanking is. A spanking is less permanent. A spanking doesn't put permanent injury or chemicals or substances into your body that can then cause all sorts of problems, myocarditis, cancers, all the things that are cropping up. So I guess if we're going to look for a Fourth Amendment place to argue that we have an enumerated right not to be vaccinated, I think that's where we'd have to go, because I can't think of any other enumerated right that would possibly provide precedent for saying we need not get vaccinated without full, a voluntary, fully informed consent. And I'm, really adamant about this. I think that your body is your temple. I think your body, you own it. If you own anything in this world, I'm thinking about it, you're born with nothing but your body. You're born naked with nothing but a body. That is your body. And no one should ever touch it, inject it, do surgery on it, do anything without your fully informed and fully voluntary consent. So I feel like this is about it. I can't think of any right more fundamental than the right not to have people perform medical procedures on your body, other than the right to life itself, not to be killed. And there's actually some crossover here, because people are dying from the vaccination. So, I mean, some people are not necessarily a high percentage, but you're talking about coercing and forcing people to do something that could kill them, and saying, oh, well, it's unlikely that, you'll die from it. Yeah, what if you do? It doesn't matter. Like someone said to me, well, it's a small percentage. I was like, you know what? And I said this before my mom died after getting the Pfizer vaccine. I said, you know what? When it's your mom or your dad or your brother, it doesn't matter if it's, one person who dies or 100 million. It's your family. And so I think that's just a bad, that argument sounds like the Hunger Games to me. It's just sacrifice a few for the, in the best interest of society. I just think that's a really bad argument. That's trading lives. And imagine if you, saved, 100, criminals, but you killed Gandhi. Well, it's this whole idea of counting lives and saying, well, some can die for the benefit of others. And then this vaccine, we don't even know. It doesn't prevent people from getting it. It doesn't prevent transmission. So it's not, we don't even know that this vaccine or so-called vaccine is even doing the job they're telling us it's going to do. The only thing I've heard that might be reliable, and I heard it recently on the radio, they're finally qualifying the benefits of these so-called vaccines. They're saying it can help you have a less severe case of COVID if you get COVID after getting vaccinated. All right. Well, again, that's a really individual response. And when it comes to our bodies, we need to decide for ourselves. So I feel there's a very clear, strong, fundamental right. I don't think we can call it an absolute right, though, only because of history and tradition. I'm not sure how absolute that right. Actually, we might be able to. If we argue the English common law and argue the law in this country before 1850, we might be able to say it was like an absolute right. The problem is that throughout history, in the last, say, 100 years, even with Skinner, with Roe, with strict scrutiny. So it wasn't an absolute right. It was the government has to justify it through a very stringent test. And they should have to justify a vaccine mandate. For goodness sakes, these things, I mean, it's killing some people. They want to force or coerce our people to get vaccinated. They should have the burden of proof. Unfortunately, our courts are getting it wrong, as you well know. They're applying rational basis review, which is a complete abdication of the court's responsibility. I'm offended by the lower courts just shrugging their shoulders and saying, well, leave it to the legislature. What if the legislature's been lied to? What if the legislature has a motive that is questionable? What if it turns out that most of them have huge stock in Big Pharma, which they do, by the way? I mean, we're dealing with a very complicated situation where our people are being kind of used like guinea pigs and really aren't being informed of that fact. And now with so many people getting cancer and dying, now we're getting at least some traction with getting the people to see that they've been lied to.
Yeah, it's very upsetting. And my experience with the judges, that this most recent decision that I got in the booster mandate case has been the best decision I've gotten, because even though she didn't rule in our favor, she at least addressed the arguments. Whereas in all of my other cases, the judges didn't even address the arguments. And it's amazing to me, because I've argued with the federal government, I've argued with the state government multiple times, and I've been in front of three judges about this. And it's crazy to me, because I feel like if you went to a law school and gave this fact pattern and Jacobson to, like, somebody who's been in law school for 2 weeks, they would be able to distinguish it in a million ways. And here we are, like, in front of these federal judges, and the federal judges are pretending that there's no distinction. It's wild, because it's ideological. It feels ideological to me, which is the reason that I don't like, like, I would much prefer to, I don't know, kind of like Thomas's view on, like, let's the Constitution, it's one step. Has the government, they can't do it now, as opposed to doing that.
Well, one thing the court did was it actually cited a prior night. It was actually the Washington versus Glucksberg case, and it was in the Ninth Circuit before it went to the U.S. Supreme Court. And what happened was the Ninth Circuit, probably a three-panel court, I'm guessing, three members of the court decided that there was a constitutional right to assisted suicide, and an en banc review was requested, and a majority of the court denied it. And one of the justices dissented to denying the full court, the full Ninth Circuit's court review of that decision. And one of the things this court said, and the Supreme Court in Dobbs v. Jackson cited this opinion and talked about what this other judge said. I think it's O'Scanlan, the judge, who said, listen, if we're going to say that everything we think is really important is a fundamental right, then why can't we say prostitution's a fundamental right? Why can't we say that illegal drugs are a fundamental right? What stops us from saying anything's a fundamental right if it can't be traceable back hundreds of years, you know, in our jurisprudence and that of the English common law? And so I think that this court, by saying that, by reiterating what the Ninth Circuit judge said, is making a really important point. There has to be some limits. Just because nine members of a court, or actually five, just because five Americans think, well, everyone should have the right to, smoke pot. It's a fundamental right to smoke pot. And actually, that's one that might be traceable hundreds of years, because I've read accounts where the founding fathers were drinking alcohol and smoking pot because they were, you know, working such long hours in the basement of that Philadelphia church or whatever. Let's say cocaine, or let's say some other drug that is clearly not traceable back to hundreds of years of use legally. And I'm not even sure about cocaine. I heard that was actually legal, but fentanyl, okay, something that was new, something that is new, manufactured, synthetic. The arguments that support Roe, that supported that court's opinion, could conceivably be used to support a right of prostitution or a right to use fentanyl. And that's what this court is saying. We've got to have parameters. We've got to have, it has to mean something to be a fundamental right. And what this court said is what it means. It has to be grounded in our history and tradition. It has to be considered really critical to the concept of ordered liberty. It has to be something so dear to us, so important to us. Marriage, raising your own children, the right to reject someone touching you if you don't want them to touch you, and that includes the right to reject medication. So any more comments, Dana, on Kavanaugh? Kavanaugh was just saying, basically, he said, we don't have this is not our, we don't, He was saying federalism requires us to let the states do what they do in this regard. He says, we are neutral. He kept saying we're neutral. He kept saying, you know, he says at the very end of his opinion, he says, in my judgment on the issue of abortion, the Constitution is neither pro-life nor pro-choice. The Constitution is neutral, and this court likewise must be scrupulously neutral. So what he's just saying is that our job is to determine whether it's a fundamental right or not. And our job is to trace back the history, and I would argue that's the lawyer's job, to hand it to the court on a silver platter, although realistically their clerks are phenomenal, generally speaking. The U.S. Supreme Court clerks do the work themselves oftentimes. But with lower courts in particular, I'm not sure their clerks are as, I'm not sure they're as supported, the lower courts, as the U.S. Supreme Court. So I say it's our job, and that's why we're doing it. So Dana and Dina, we are doing this. I'm going to be writing the amicus brief, and then explain to the court why our right to reject medical treatments go way back hundreds of years. I've got some authority back to the 1400s. And again, if you can support us, because we're both working for free largely, although Nations in Action has come forward and given me a retainer to do some of this work, please go to meettheprofessors.org and click on the donate button. And as I said earlier, 50% of the donations in the next 30 days will go to Dana, because she's been working for free. All of the donations will go directly to litigation costs, to lawsuit costs, attorney's fees, and costs of court. And also, don't forget to donate to Revolution Radio. Get on freedomslips.com and make a donation today if you can, or go to the Zazzle store and buy one of the very nice artistic products there, where you're donating to the station anytime you buy any product on Zazzle. So I'm going to go to now Justice Roberts' opinion, and my personal opinion is that the two best opinions are Roberts's and Kavanaugh's. And the problem I had with the majority opinion was that I don't think that opinion was clear enough as to what it means. And the fact that they kept reiterating, oh, this, we're not talking about Lawrence v. Texas, we're not talking about gay marriage, we're not talking about this or that. I mean, based on the opinion, yes, they are. I mean, they're saying that you have to trace the right back hundreds of years in order for it to be recognized as fundamental. So I don't know how you can say the opinion doesn't mean that. So that's the problem I have with the majority opinion. Roberts had a different tact. Roberts said, basically, we don't have to overrule Roe. All we have to do is declare this Mississippi law constitutional. It gives women 15 weeks to figure out they're pregnant and a reasonable opportunity to get an abortion. So what Roberts was saying is, why are we overruling Roe? Why do we need to do that? We don't need to do that for this case. And normally the court will not make a ruling that isn't critical. Normally the court statements about Roe would be dictum, because they don't need to overrule Roe necessarily to hold this law constitutional. But you have a sense, Dana, as to why the court went ahead and overruled Roe versus Wade and Casey versus Planned Parenthood, even though I don't think it was critical to the decision in Dobbs versus Jackson?
I don't know. I haven't read Roberts' opinion yet, but I don't understand how they could hold the statute of the Constitution without overruling Roe.
Well, Casey didn't overrule Roe, and Casey made and overruled a lot of Roe, in my opinion. Casey sort of overruled any idea that the right of abortion is found anywhere other than the 14th Amendment. Casey changed the rule to undue burden throughout the trimester framework. So Casey really limited Roe without overruling it. So I'm saying this court could have done that. If they wanted to, they could say, well, states are given more latitude to decide when a woman has a sufficient opportunity to have an abortion. It is a right, you know, they can even say, but they could also say, but because viability is getting, you know, earlier and earlier, and because that baby, that fetus also, you know, has an interest, or the state has an interest in the fetus. And the court said that over and over again when distinguishing cases like Lawrence v. Texas, the right of sodomy, the privacy in the bedroom among, you know, people, whatever they want to do, basically, homosexual sex, whatever it is, that Lawrence v. Texas said, that's your private life. That's fundamental. So, you know, I'm not sure about all that, but I think that the court is going to overrule Lawrence v. Texas. most likely. I'm not sure about gay marriage. I know, and that concerns me because people have been shunned who are homosexual for throughout history. And I feel like they've been put down at such a level, and what they're doing is in the privacy of their bedroom.
Yeah.
I guess the key, though, the key is not to get caught. I mean, realistically, I mean, in Bowers versus Hardwick, as I recall, the door was open. I mean, a police officer was like, I can't remember the whole fact, but the door was ajar. Okay, a pretty good idea to shut your bedroom door. Just one thing, one layer of protection against being charged with a crime when you're doing something that some states think is illegal, immoral, and therefore criminal. So anyway, any more comments on any of those? Because I want to get to now the dissent, because the dissent said something in the first few pages that struck me as incredibly disingenuous and fear-mongering, and I want to point that out. Did you have a chance to see any part of the dissent?
No, I haven't read it.
Dissent had a tough time. I mean, you know, they didn't really go into history and tradition. They tried to do the same thing Roe did and kind of say, you know, certain rights are so critical to women having some, you know, equal opportunity to compete in the workplace, to not be saddled with an unwanted child. But they didn't have, I mean, I didn't have time to read through it all, but one of the things that was said up front, and I saw this and I thought, wait a minute, I think I sent you an email on this, is the court said, and I didn't flag this, so I have to kind of look through and see if I can find it. Listen to this. Most threatening of all, no language in today's decision stops the federal government from prohibiting abortions nationwide. Once again, from the moment of conception without exceptions for rape or incest. Okay, Supreme Court Justices Breyer, Sotomayor, and Kagan, where in Article 1 does Congress possibly have the authority to ban abortion?
I seem like the Democrat politicians, they've been saying this, but really the Supreme Court justices ought to know better.
I mean, this is a thing that's so fundamental to our Constitution is Congress's powers are limited by Article 1, Section 8. If you can't find an enumerated power of Congress, you can't act. And we've seen the court strike down legislation, especially since 89, based on like the Commerce Clause. Things for 60 years, there wasn't a single piece of legislation knocked out. But then they started doing it. And then also with the Violence Against Women's Act, I think it's called, where the court said, you know what, that there is a provision in the 14th Amendment that allows Congress to act. It's Section 5 of the 14th Amendment, the enforcement provision. Congress can act, but they have to be acting to remedy a longstanding form of discrimination, like racial discrimination, gender, with the Equal Pay Act that Kennedy signed. Before he was murdered, actually, John F. Kennedy would have signed Title VII. He had just signed the Equal Pay Act in, I think, June, and then he was killed, and then Lyndon B. Johnson actually signed into law Title VII. A little bit of interesting history there that JFK was going to do both, but he wasn't able to. But so we do have, and that's been over and over again held by the courts. So they have enforcement under the 14th Amendment. They can act to remedy longstanding types of discrimination. But we've seen other acts get knocked out right and left by the court in the last 20, 30 years because Congress didn't have the authority. So my question to these three is, how on earth could Congress ever act to ban abortion? I see no basis for that. In fact, I have a problem with the PrEP Act. I have a problem with the National Childhood Vaccine Injury Act. Where does Congress have the authority to regulate tort liability? And worse than that, to immunize an entire industry called Big Pharma. See, I think what we're seeing right now is we're living in the most interesting constitutional times, I think, in the last, you know, 30, 40, 50 years. Because I think what I want to do and where some of this funding will go if you donate to us is starting to challenge some of these laws, some of these congressional acts on non-delegation grounds. Where's your authority? And if you say, oh, taxing and spending emergency, oh, Commerce Clause, okay, at some point, someone has to get real and say, what are you really doing? You're really regulating tort liability. Sorry, that's a 10th Amendment state right. So I think that we need to start getting very active and say our Congress has not protected us adequately. Prior Supreme Court has not. And Justice Sotomayor, I'm disappointed in, because her dissenting opinion in Brusewitz was so profound to me, so meaningful to me, and here she is now taking the side of the vaccine manufacturers time and time again. I'm like, what happened to your dissent in Brusewitz? What happened? It sounds like politics and fear-mongering are affecting our justices, too.
It's really unfortunate. Justice Sotomayor and Justice Gorsuch together have teamed up on the issue of privacy so well on multiple occasions. And it's a nice little team. I like to see them come together on the issue of privacy. And I wonder if, and I know, obviously, we know how she ruled on the CMS mandate and the OSHA, but I wonder if she could be persuaded that this is an issue of privacy.
Or of hurting people. She talked about, when, remember what Brusewitz was, the National Childhood Vaccine Injury Act only applied to strict liability. And that means they were problems, dangers, injuries that were not foreseeable. They're just things that every kind of medication could kill somebody. Aspirin, Advil could kill somebody. And some things are so unforeseeable that you can't get liability unless you have strict liability. So in Brusewitz, what happens, the U.S. Supreme Court said that the National Childhood Vaccine Injury Act also applies to negligence. Now, that's foreseeable. So they immunized the vaccine manufacturers from negligence-based claims, which was, I think, a huge stretch. But Congress didn't react and amend the National Childhood Vaccine Injury Act or you know, to protect us all against negligence-based big pharma behavior that end up, you know, killing children or hurting children. But one of the things she kept saying in the dissent that I remember so well was, you know, kids are going to get hurt. And, you know, and more kids are going to get hurt if you immunize from negligence. So I think we need to look very carefully at some of these acts. And the Fifth Circuit made an opinion recently that the SEC, the delegation of power to the SEC by Congress, is partially beyond Article I scope. They said Congress acted beyond its delegated powers. So they applied a what I call a first-tier non-delegation argument, saying Congress did not have the authority to create the SEC as it did. They also said what I call a second-level argument in non-delegation is that the SEC overstepped its boundaries, that some of the delegated power might have been valid, but they overstepped their boundaries in doing certain things. And then the third tier, the third level of non-delegation is a case I have that I'm looking for funding for right now, where this university had no authority whatsoever, no delegated authority at all that we can find. In fact, they even said they're relying on the CDC website in passing this mandate. So that pretty much seems like an admission to me. They didn't have authority.
And that's what the federal mandates will fall on. Like, in Smith v. Biden, I think it has to come down to the fact that the president just doesn't have this authority. The federal government just doesn't have police power.
Well, and that's not even what they said in the OSHA case. In the OSHA case, what they said was that the authority given to OSHA just didn't cover, you know, day-to-day healthcare issues. It was about keeping workers safe in the workplace. And COVID isn't something that happens in the workplace. Wearing a hard hat so you don't get hit in the head in a blasting operation, you know, that's an OSHA-related situation, but not a virus that's going around society. So
there
we have just
about permanent modification to your body.
It was really a strange. I like the Fifth Circuit opinion because the Fifth Circuit, well, a lot of these justices are so smart. They were very sarcastic at the Fifth Circuit, saying that they were just looking for a place and they landed on OSHA and it didn't work out for them. Dana, thank you so much for being with me. I look forward to working with you and working on this brief together, the amicus brief I'm writing for you. It's going to be fun. It's going to be interesting. And we're going to have to convince the courts, the Supreme Court, it's time to recognize vaccines or medication. They can't be forced on people.
Dana, thank you. Thank you
all
so
right.
much. I'm so happy to
meet you. Thank you. I forgot you. Talk to you soon.
We'll be right back.
Freedomnation.radio. Freedomslips.com.
Join me at Revolution Radio, Studio B, at 11 a.m. on Saturday for Free Association, when we take a look at philosophy, spirituality, psychology, social issues, and geopolitics. It's every Saturday at 11 a.m. Eastern on Studio B at freedomslips.com.